1 John 3:19 through 3:22. The 13th talk in a series on John's letters was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 18, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good morning. It's been a number of weeks, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time reviewing. I'll be reviewing section 3 in the translation that you have. That would be up till verse 18 of chapter 3, if you have a real Bible, a normal Bible. And then we're going to look at section 4, which goes from chapter 3, verse 19, through verse 6 of chapter 4. So that's what we want to look at. The heart of this letter, which starts in what I'm calling section 3, the heart of this letter consists of four discussions, I think. It's hard to know what to call them, assertions, theses. They're just sort of four propositions that he lays out and that he develops, and they are four distinct propositions. But all of them are concerned with the issue of who has eternal life, who inherits eternal life. It comes in different ways and different forms. Who's a child of God? Who's of the truth? Who's a faithful disciple of Jesus? He casts it differently each time, but the issue is the same throughout. Who is it that's going to be saved? And then he plays with three or four different criteria for how you can judge whether or not you are going to inherit eternal life. And one of the reasons that the letter is so confounding to try to interpret, especially when you first confront it, is all those themes are all wound together. And if you try to chase any one of those themes, it doesn't seem to logically divide up into discrete chunks. But what I hope that I have done, what I think that I have done, is identified those discrete chunks, and that's what I'm calling the sections of this letter. So this first section, section 3, that we looked at last week, and let me review that a little bit. In that section, he raises the question, who's a child of God? And he makes an assertion that the child of God is the one who does righteousness, and a corollary to that, not only does he do righteousness, but he loves those who do righteousness. He calls it your brother, but in the context of this section, the one who's a brother is one who's a fellow lover of righteousness, one who is committed to righteousness. And I tried to clarify both of those issues last time. On the one hand, what does he mean by do righteousness? We can be incredibly misled by that if we think that what John is saying is the one who's a child of God is the one who actually transcends their own unrighteousness and sinfulness and evil such that they are no longer a sinner, so that they no longer their lives are no longer touched by sin in any way. And I argue that that's not what he's saying. He's not saying that we human beings here and now on this earth can transcend the reality of our own sinfulness. We remain sinners and will remain sinners till the day we die and go to another age, enter into another phase of existence. As long as we are here and now living under the sun, we remain and will remain sinners. So John is not denying that. But there's two kinds of sinners. There are sinners who defend, excuse, rationalize, tolerate, and otherwise welcome and accept the reality of their sinfulness. And there are sinners who stand against and repudiate their own sinfulness. Their imagination, their vision, their heart's commitment is against what comes so naturally to them. They do not want to be the sinner that they in fact are. And so, with an authentic and significant effort against their own sinfulness, they strive to make choices and adapt attitudes and have perceptions and have beliefs that are committed to what's good and right and just and true and loving, as opposed to not. And that's what John means by doing righteousness. We need to remember the context. he's writing against a whole school of thought that by the evidence of this letter, is far more tolerant of sin than John thinks is righteous. And so when he talks about the child of God as the one who does righteousness, in the background are those people who do sin in the sense that they not only practice it, but they defend it, excuse it, and tolerate it in their lives. And that's what he's standing against. Then the other thing I tried to clarify is that when he talks about loving those people who love righteousness, this section is not primarily about love. And I think that's where the letter of 1 John is misunderstood more than in any other way. Is it's so easy to read this letter and come away saying, I don't know what this letter is just talking about, but whatever it's talking about, he wants us to love one another. And this is about love. This is what the letter of 1 John is all about. Actually, he spends relatively little time on love. And when he does in this section, what he's talking about is your attitude toward righteousness, not your attitude toward love. Now, not that the other's not there, and I'll come to that in a second. But fundamentally, in the argument that he's making, the reason that love for the brother is important in this section is because John thinks, and this theme's going to come up several times, John thinks the way the litmus test of whether or not I love righteousness is what is my attitude toward it when I see it embodied in another human being. If I confront another human being whose life is committed to righteousness, do I despise them for it? Do I hate them for it? Do I mock them for it? Do I hold them in contempt for it? Or do I somehow respond with a kind of affection and fondness because they are what a human being ought to be? And it's attractive to me, it's interesting to me that they are that kind of human being. So this idea of loving your brother is not about love, it's about what is your attitude toward the embodiment of righteousness in another human being. So you could paraphrase it. It's not so much that we need to love our brother, as what he really means, I think, is we ought at all costs to not hold righteous people in contempt. Don't hold the believer in contempt. If you're hostile toward him and you hold him in contempt, you are not a child of God, he says. I ended last time by talking about how we use this and how we can abuse this section about loving your brother. There's this evil thread in us that loves to get the upper hand on other people spiritually. And there are certain key aspects of the Christian faith that are the ace up the sleeve of us hypocrites, where we know that we can skewer the other person and get the upper hand if we want to, if we need to, in a pinch. And one of those is love. Have you loved enough? You who drive your fancy cars to Safeway while people elsewhere in the world are starving, do you love enough? You who concern yourselves with the everyday affairs of your own life when there are other people in the congregation who have needs that are going unmet because you're not meeting, have you loved enough? Well, I can always win that game because I guarantee you, you have never loved enough. I guarantee it. Who of us has loved enough? Who of us is capable of loving enough? And I don't for a second mean to defang the stinging challenge of John's words here, because I think they are very real. The paragraph where he talks about don't love in word and with, what is it? How's he put it? Tongue and word. But in deed and in truth, in thought and in speech, but in deed and in truth. That is a stinging challenge to every one of us that we need to take seriously. The fact of the matter is, I cringe every time I read of Jesus' life. The level of his sacrifice, the level at which he was committed to other people and their well-being and their welfare and their goodness rather than his own. And by comparison, I look like an utterly selfish creep. And I know that, and I feel that. But the question at that point is, what do we do with that reality? What do we do with that fact? we can take that reality and I think quite evilly use that to put other people down. You are not as loving as Jesus is, so what are you going to do about that? The implication being, of course I am. Of course I'm committed to being loving in the same way that Jesus is. That's a very evil thing to do, because we are all in the same boat. We are all selfish. We are all unloving. We are all self-protective in a way that we ought not to be. So John's words need to sting us and challenge us to be ever more ready to purge the self-centeredness out of our lives. But I would maintain that as long as we are sinners here in this world, we will always be overly self-centered. It's just going to be a given of our existence and a given of our life. And we need to weep at the reality of our self-centeredness. So I don't for a second want to minimize the challenge of that on the one hand. But on the other hand, we need to understand what John is saying. John is not coming along and saying, if you are unloving, you are not a believer. You are not a child of God. It's not his point. His point is, if you don't have the kind of attraction and fondness and affection and simpatico with other people out there whose lives are committed to the same vision of reality that yours is, namely the righteousness of our Creator and our God, if you don't find yourself attracted to that aspect of them, then how can you claim to be a child of God? They are trying to be like their father. Later in the book, he's going to say, how can you claim to love God whom you cannot see when you hate the brother whom you can see? God is just then an abstraction. If the incarnation of that vision and that set of values that make God God, you see that enfleshed in a person committed to that, imperfectly granted, but nonetheless committed to that, and you hate them for that, then how can you make a valid claim to love God when you hate and reject and hold in contempt the very person who does love God? It doesn't make any sense, John says. And that's the same point. That's exactly the point I think that he's making in this section. And then one last final point of clarification. The personality differences that separate us are huge barriers. It takes a lot of time to get to know and respect and like and feel warm toward those differences that set people apart from me. Ethnic, cultural, racial, personality differences, sexual differences, all those differences that make us not automatically understand who people are and where they're coming from. Those are huge barriers, and it takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes charity on our part to do that. John is not saying that every believer who claims to be a believer and who authentically is a believer but is a stranger to us is ought to automatically be my friend. That's not his point. His point is, while there may be all kinds of reasons why they are alienated from you and estranged from you because of their personality and culture and other reasons, it ought not to be their commitment to righteousness that drives you away and alienates you. That part of who they are ought to bond you to them, even if you don't understand the other aspects of what makes them tick. Because remember in that section, the paradigm example he used was Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel, he says, and why did he kill him? For no other reason than that Abel's deeds were righteous and Cain's deeds were evil. He hated him for his righteousness. He hated him for his righteous deeds. That's the example that he's giving to inform what he means by loving the brother here. Okay, all that was to catch us up by way of review. Now we enter into section 4, which is the next point that he wants to make. It's the next assertion, the next discussion. And let me read that, starting with paragraph 24. This is chapter 3, verse 19. I'm starting. Now by this we shall know that we are of the truth. Indeed, we shall assure our heart before him that... I'm going to change the because to that, and I'll talk about that in a second. Indeed, we shall assure our heart before him that if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, when our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence with respect to God, or I think better, before God. And then I'll change the that to and. And we are getting from him what we are requesting. So we shall know that we are of the truth by the fact that we are keeping his instructions and doing what is pleasing to him. And this is his instruction, that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus, the Messiah, and that we love one another just as Jesus gave us instruction. I'm now prepared to move this next sentence down to paragraph 25. I think it's the opening of paragraph 25. Now the one who keeps Jesus' instructions is remaining with Jesus, and Jesus is remaining with him. Now by this we know that Jesus remains with us apostles from the spirit that he gave to us. Beloved, do not believe every spirit. Rather, evaluate the spirits to see if they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges Jesus to be the Messiah, even though he has come in human flesh, is from God. And every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. Indeed, this is the spirit of Antichrist, about which you heard that it was coming. And indeed, it is now in the world already. You are from God, precious offspring. You have been victorious over them, because greater is that which is in you than that which is in the world. They are from the world. Because they are from the world, they speak, and the world listens to them. We are from God. The one who knows God listens to us. The one who is not from God does not listen to us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Okay, he starts by framing the question in terms of, he wants to discuss who is of the truth. Now, what does he mean by of the truth? I think very simply all he means is who is one who is a faithful disciple of the truth, who's a follower of the truth. And remember the background here. There seems to be a tension between the apostles and these false teachers, competing claims about who is faithfully, without distortion, representing the teaching of Jesus, which, of course, was the revelation of God to mankind. They seem to be roughly in agreement about that. Jesus was a great teacher and had a message to give us from God. Both the apostles and the false teachers agree on that. The difference of opinion is, what did Jesus say? The truth that ultimately had its origin in God, who's representing that truth to the world? Who's a faithful disciple of that? Who's a faithful follower of that? Who's a faithful teacher of that truth? And in this case, the issue is, with respect to John's readers, who has believed and is following and living in the light of that which is really the truth, with a capital T, come from God. And he wants to lay out what he thinks is the criteria for who that person is. He says, by this we shall know that we are of the truth. And then he interrupts his thought, and he has a parenthesis, a very profound parenthesis, I think. But then when he gets back to his main point of laying out the criteria by which we can judge whether someone's of the truth, he says, the one who is of the truth is the one that is keeping his instructions, God's instructions, I think, and doing what is pleasing to him. Now, let me skip down there first. What does he mean by keeping his instructions and doing what is pleasing to him? We've talked about keeping here. I think to keep the instructions or keep teaching is a sort of pregnant phrase that has many, many, that embodies many different, a couple of different aspects to it in a single concept. It's to preserve, but I think what's behind that is, you know, when I keep a keepsake, I'm taking something that for some reason is valuable to me, and I'm wanting to safeguard it, protect it, preserve it, keep it from being destroyed, keep it from being lost. I think that's the sense in which John talks about keeping the teaching of Jesus. If you value the teaching of Jesus, if you think that it's worth something, then you will seek to preserve it, both from being lost to memory, on the one hand, but even more importantly, keep it safe from distortion, safe from perversion, safe from being transformed. You want to preserve its purity and its accuracy, as well as its legacy, its memory. So that's one aspect of it. So this idea that I would take the teaching of Jesus seriously and want to pass it on faithfully to other people as well as know it and believe it for myself. That's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is John thinks that there's no way anyone is really keeping Jesus' teaching if they don't also live their lives in the light of that teaching, conform their lives to what Jesus instructed. And that's where we typically, in our idiom, when we talk about keeping the law, we think of it as a synonym for obeying the law, for doing what the law says. And that's certainly part of what John is saying, but that's a derivative sense. The primary sense, I think, is to keep the instruction of Jesus is to value it and then act in a way that's consistent with that attitude that I value it. I preserve it, I memorize it, I keep it from distortion, I do obey it, I do honor it with the choices I make in my life and so on. And all that, I think, is implied by keeping his instruction. That's why I think keeping his instruction and doing what is pleasing to him are not two different criteria or two different ideas. I think it is one and the same idea. It's just one idea expressed in two things connected by and. Let me give you an example of that. If I said, I am going to be buying a if in a fit of midlife crisis, I say, I am going to be buying a surfboard and getting some plastic surgery done, that's two things. But if I say, I am going to be buying a surfboard and chasing the world's wildest surf, that's really one thing. If I say, you must honor your contracts and tell the truth in all the claims you make, that's two things. If I say you must honor your contracts and abide by every term that is in them, that's one thing. I'm basically simply saying, by the addition, I'm saying what I mean by honoring my contract is specifically abiding by its terms. And really what I mean is you need to abide by its terms and thereby honor the contract. I think that's what John is saying here. You are keeping his instructions and doing what is pleasing to him. What he's saying is you are valuing his instructions enough that you do everything that's entailed by that, including living your life in the light of them, thereby pleasing God, and in that way keep his instructions. It's really just one thing. The reason I argue that is because if it's two things, the second one gets dropped in this section entirely. He never comes back to it. Throughout this section, it's what's in view is valuing Jesus' teaching enough that I honor it by upholding what he taught. I believe what he taught rather than disbelieve what he taught, and that's what this section is all about. Okay, but he had interrupted that point. Let me finish and come back to the interruption. And this is his instruction. Now, Jesus taught us a lot of things, but there's one thing in particular that's in view in this letter that is a point at issue between the false teachers and the apostles, and this is the one he wants to highlight. This is his instruction that we believe in the name of his Son, Jesus, the Messiah, and that we love one another just as Jesus gave us instruction. So the point at issue is, who is this man Jesus? And I would argue that believing in the name of his Son, Jesus the Messiah, is his way of saying, believing that Jesus did in fact have the role and the function and the authority that Jesus claimed for himself in his teaching. Jesus taught that he was the Son sent from God. Jesus taught that he was the Messiah. And in making that claim, he was either right or wrong. If I'm going to keep his teaching, if I'm going to keep his own teaching about himself, then I'm going to embrace that as true, that Jesus really, in fact, was the Son, the Messiah sent from God. The false teachers have not done so. They've rejected that claim. And so John is basically saying, who is of the truth, then? The one who's of the truth is the one who keeps Jesus' teaching. What was Jesus teaching? That he was the Messiah. The false teachers aren't keeping the truth, then. And in not keeping the truth, they are not followers of the truth that God sent into the world to reveal to mankind. Fundamentally, that's his basic and simple point in this paragraph. But But he interrupts that with this really incredibly profound point, I think. He says, indeed, we shall assure our heart before him that, change the because to that, if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. John is using heart here in, I think, a rather unusual sense. There are other places in the New Testament I found where it gets used in a similar way. But typically, what the New Testament writers mean by heart has more to do with the underlying moral commitments of my life, the values that I'm committed to, the worldview that I'm committed to, the perspectives that I'm committed to. And it's a more, has to do with the understanding and the intellect and the rationality and belief system. Here, I would argue, John is using heart to talk more about what we would call feelings. It's what we feel. It's my inward thoughts, but it's my, well, the thing that those have in common, what's the core meaning of heart? The core meaning of the word heart is the core of something, in the way that we talk about the heart of the forest. You know, going deep into the center, into the inside of a forest is the heart of the forest. That's really what the word heart means in the way that it gets used by the New Testament writers. So it's what Kierkegaard calls inwardness. But there are different kinds of inwardness. There's different aspects to inwardness. There's my inward thoughts. There's my inward convictions. There's my inward commitments. But there's also my inward feelings. Those two can be inward. And mostly the New Testament is talking about my inward commitments. Here, I believe, it's talking about our inward feelings. We all know the phenomenon that he's talking about. It's that inner voice inside that tells us all kinds of mean, nasty things. You are a loser. You are a nothing. You are worthless. You are guilty. You are condemned. You are wrong. You are bad. I mean, just all those things that inner voice tells us over and over and over again. Some of us are tortured by that voice because it is informing us supposedly of the truth about my existence, the truth about the reality of my experience. And it's compelling because it feels so strong. It feels so intense. It feels so vivid. John is saying, John knows that phenomenon, apparently, and most importantly, he recognizes that that's a dynamic at work in his reader's life. And you can put yourself in their shoes, and I know exactly what they're experiencing. You have the generation of your parents who have supposedly listened to the apostles, been taught Christianity by the apostles, telling you that this is what they said and this is what the faith is all about. Then you have these charismatic younger generation teachers riding into town on a white horse telling you, no, they've got it all wrong. Let me set you straight. Here's what Jesus really said. We have it on good authority that this is actually what Jesus taught. And they say some things that are interesting to you and that are fresh and are novel and exciting and more attractive, frankly, in certain respects. And you're torn. How are you to decide who's right? How are you to decide who's true, who's speaking the truth? And what ultimately gets invoked in you is this dynamic of this inner voice telling you, boy, if you stay with that old-fashioned religion of your parents, what a fool you are. You're wrong. You're being conservative. You're being too cautious. You're being too fearful. You're not listening to the voice of God. God sent these new teachers into town. What are you going to quench the spirit? You know, are you going to deny the reality of what God is trying to teach you just out of fear? And this inner voice goes to work on you to try to soften you up. To try to make you open to changing your mind. John knows the dynamic, and many of you have felt that at one time or another in your life. I'll never forget the first time I confronted the charismatic movement in my experience and the claims that they were making. And the guy sitting in the living room talking about how you can drive to heaven in a Volkswagen or you can drive to heaven in a Cadillac. It's up to you. Yeah, you might be saved, your sins might be forgiven, but are you going to miss out on all the blessings that God and all the power that God has for you now by denying the work of the Spirit in your life that the charismatics are describing? And the inner turmoil that created in me with those inner voices telling me to pay attention, to listen to this new teaching. That had to be what John's readers are experiencing and encountering here. John knows that, and so he addresses that issue in a very profound and important way. What he says is, there's a criteria here, and this criterion is objective. Now, of course, all these criteria are subject to interpretation. They're a judgment call, that's true, and there's a subjective dimension to them because it's me doing the judging. But there is nonetheless an objective reality that can be the standard, the measuring stick by which I can know whether I am of the truth or not of the truth. And that objective measuring stick, that objective standard is, what do you do with Jesus? In this case, in their context, what do you do with Jesus? Do you accept his claim to be the Messiah, or do you reject his claim to be the Messiah? If you don't have a problem with that claim, John says, then that's an objective evidence that you are of the truth. And given that objective evidence that you are of the truth, just tell the inner voice to shut up. Just convince your heart of this very important fact, that God is greater than our heart and knows all things. The point he's making is, who ultimately knows the dynamics of my existence? Who ultimately knows the truth about me? That inner voice inside of me, or God, the Creator, my Maker, my King and my Lord? Does he know the truth about me, or does that inner voice inside of me know better than God does? And John's point is, with the right kind of objective evidence, if we will honor the evidence, if we will listen to the evidence, if we will look at the evidence, we can convince ourselves of two things: that God knows better than we do, and God, who's told me that this is the measuring stick by which I can measure myself. I forgot the first part of my sentence. How do you finish that? Okay, we'll start over. I can become convinced that God is greater than my heart and knows more than my inner voice does, and because God is greater than my heart, it's God who's revealed that measuring stick, and so by that measuring stick, I can therefore know that I am of the truth, even when everything inside of me is screaming, you are a heretic, you are an infidel, you are a liar, you are going to hell. Well, the thing that John is talking about here, I think, is just exceedingly important and exceedingly profound. Because it pits, in a way, my rationality and my intelligence against, I don't even know what to call it, but whatever these inner feelings are that we know we do battle with, I don't know what to call them. But it's important that we recognize that the objective evidence that my rationality can be in touch with is closer to the truth of God than those other inner feelings that battle against us. And I dare not listen to these. I dare not listen to these inner feelings that condemn us in the face of contrary evidence. But rather, I need to look at the objective evidence of my life and believe accordingly, rather than allow myself to have my beliefs formed by the inner condemning voice that condemns me. Now, the most important area of our lives where that dynamic occurs is with respect to my salvation. Am I or am I not genuinely a child of God? And that's the issue that John is talking about here. Am I a child of God or not? And so many of us give far too much weight, far too much credence to that lying inner voice, that complaining, whining inner voice that tells me I'm not a believer, I'm not for real, I'm not authentic, I'm a hypocrite. And we listen to that voice. I think the reason we listen to the voice is because it's so loud. It doesn't have anything else going for it. It's not in touch with reality. It has no evidence that's compelling. It has no objective evidence. It just screams really loud. But because it's so loud, because it's so forceful, because it's so proactive and imposing, we listen to it. And I think what John is telling us, is instructing us, is it's really important that we allow God to be the judge of my existence, not me to be the judge of my existence. And if God points to some objective evidence that he has worked in my life to transform my life and give me eyes to see and give me ears to hear and make my heart committed to him, if I see objective evidence of that, then never mind what that voice is saying, and no matter how loud it's shouting it, never mind. I think one of the most important things that I ever learned was, in a sense, to trust the evidence over against my subjective experience. It has saved me a lot of emotional grief and emotional turmoil later in my life that I was plagued by early in my life. And I don't know how to impart that to other people, but I think John is saying what I have learned, what I have experienced, that it's very, very important that we learn to trust my reason, to trust my rational judgment about objective reality, and not be plagued and tormented by subjective reality. John's talking about eternal life, but I think the same is true of a lot of other areas of my life. Self-esteem, that inner voice that tells me I'm worthless, against the voice of God himself, the teaching of God himself, the objective evidence of divine revelation that says you are made in the image of God. And being made in the image of God, however unique you might be, being made in the image of God, you are an awesome creature. Period. There's no more to be said about that. That's the objective reality. And then we have this voice fed by I don't know what springs. But this other voice, this subjective voice in us telling us, no, you're just pond scum. You know, everybody else may be important, but you a loser, you're a nothing, you're just a lousy excuse for a creation of God. Why do we listen to that voice? It's probably fed by pride, by disappointment, by all kinds of things that are just simply not true. They're not in touch with reality. They're not based on anything real. The reality is what God says about us, not what we feel about ourselves. I could go on to all kinds of other things. The rightness of an action, the rightness of a belief, all those places where evidence is pitted against subjective feelings. And we need to learn to weigh them appropriately, just as John is suggesting his readers do here. Then he says, beloved, when our heart does not condemn us, that is when our feelings, when we've quieted the feelings, when we've silenced them by allowing the objective reality and the objective truth to trump them. Beloved, when our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. And then I changed it to and because I do think he's saying two things here, not one thing. We have confidence before God, period. In the sense of confidence before God is a complete idea in and of itself. Why? What does he mean? I think what he means is we have confidence that we stand to be blessed by God rather than destroyed by God at the judgment seat. We know where we stand. We have seen the evidence. We have faced into the evidence, and we have seen the work of God in our lives making us his children, and as children we are heirs. As his children we stand to inherit the blessing that he promised. There's nothing more to be said. And therefore I can with confidence know that that's my status. Maybe this isn't one idea, I don't know. And we are getting from him what we are requesting. The way you're your typical translation has this, I think makes this very confusing. Because I think clearly what he's saying when he says we are getting from him what we are requesting, I think he has in mind something very specific by what it is that we're requesting of him. It's informed by the entire context of the letter. It's informed by the context of this section. There is no other issue in this letter other than, am I or am I not going to receive eternal life? Am I or am I not going to have life in the age to come? That's the question. That's what the very presence of the letter being written implies is my request. John, I want eternal life. Am I going to get it or am I not going to get it? What all of us are requesting, ultimately, is life in the final age. Am I going to get it? Am I not going to get it? So when he says, and we are getting from him what we are requesting, he's making a claim that when the objective evidence has persuasively demonstrated that we are of the truth, then the fact of the matter is we are getting the desire of our heart to have life in the final age. The way many of these translations have it makes it sound like it makes this very problematic claim. It goes on to say, usually they translate it, then because we are keeping his instructions and doing what is pleasing to him. And it makes it sound like what John is saying is anyone who keeps his instructions and does what is pleasing to him will get whatever they ask in prayer. Whatever they ask for, they're going to get. And there are many, many Christians who take this passage this way as some kind of promise of answered prayer on my terms. If I'm obedient, if I'm righteous. And of course, the reason that you and I don't get our prayers answered in the way that we ask them is, well, we're not keeping his commandments and doing what is pleasing to him. So that's not evidence against it. But that can't possibly be what he's talking about, because he just drops it if that's what he's talking about. He doesn't do anything with it. It's a non sequitur. It doesn't fit into the argument of this section. It has nothing to do with anything in this section. It's just dropped in out of the blue and then undeveloped. But of course, if he's saying what I'm suggesting, then it's right at the heart of the issue of not only this section, but the entire book. We are going to get the eternal life that we are requesting from him if the objective evidence, the criteria, has been met objectively. Okay, got this dilemma. Let me ask you, are there questions or discussions at this point? Because I'm right at a time where if I launch it in the next section, there's no way in the world I can finish. But if there's not any questions, it's probably too early to stop. No one has it? Okay. Let's stop here then and open it up for discussion.
I have two questions. That's okay.
Sure.
First one was, in the context, you've talked about the context of the book being, rather than addressing the issue of Gnosticism, but it really is addressing the issue of legalism.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with your review. So the issue of how you look at your brother, is this more like, or whether you value that the fact that your brother's values righteousness, is this going at the Luke 18 issue of the person who thinks he's doing it right, viewing others with contempt kind of thing? Is that where
yes.
it's going?
Yes. Well, oh.
Okay. Or is there this objective that, I mean, it seems to me that legalism, which is what you're talking about, the book here, is interested in looking at itself as doing it right, but really not wanting to do it right. So it's kind of it's fooling myself. It's a facade kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. I see a somewhat different scenario there on the one hand. On the other hand, if you take it far enough, it's the same issue.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, in Luke 18, where he says, trusted himself that he was righteous and viewed others with contempt, I think the contempt that he's talking about there is a view of superiority. I, as a righteous Pharisee, hold you, a tax gatherer, in contempt because you are a scoundrel and a godless infidel. And because I'm superior to you, I look down on you and hold you in that kind of contempt. I think the contempt he's talking about is probably exemplified more by that scene where is it a prostitute who comes in and dumps perfume on Jesus' feet and wipes weeps
Luke 7,
on
Luke 7.
Yeah. That they held her in contempt partly for the same reason, I'm sure. She's a prostitute and they're Pharisees, so obviously they feel superior. But I think that contempt is further fueled by the fact that Jesus accepts her love as a genuine and authentic response that a human being should make. And I think if we were to get inside the heart of the Pharisees at that point, they would hate her for that as well. They would hate her for loving Jesus.
So it's a very different view of righteousness then.
Yes.
And they wouldn't see their view, they didn't see her gift as love. They didn't see it rightly. Whereas they would look at themselves and say, oh, we're doing it right because...
Well, it comes back to Cain and Abel. I mean, ultimately, this is just a judgment call we need to make based on our own experience in human psychology. But what was Cain thinking about Abel? Did he think that Abel really hadn't done the right thing? I'm sure probably that would have been his argument. That would have been his rationalization. That would have been his defense. But I have to wonder if somewhere deep down inside, Cable didn't realize that Abel had done exactly the right thing and he hated him for it.
And it kind of exposed him.
And it exposed him as a consequence, yeah. And maybe that's partly why we hate people who are righteous, because precisely because it exposes us, yeah. But that I think is what John is pinpointing, is that animosity I have towards someone who does the right thing when I know that they've done the right thing and I hate them for the fact that they've done the right thing. It's a very real human phenomenon.
Okay, my second question has to do with this paragraph that you just looked at. And you're talking about this conflict between what our heart tells us, and as opposed to what's objectively true, and that what we listen to. And I was thinking you were talking about the words to describe this, not knowing the words. I think it's kind of this fears and belief thing that I talk about in the model, and it comes about, I think, from having life experiences where we are taught that. And the reason there's such a conflict sometimes is because we actually believe it, or there are people who believe it. And I think the more traumatic the experience, the life experience, the harder it is to believe something other than that, that even is objectively true. And I think what John is getting at here is really important, because it's something that you can take people to. It's not just by saying the words, but by how you relate to them and the commitment that you have to goodness and to truth and in that relationship. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You are describing a difficulty in people, in relating to people who struggle with this, and helping them see what's true. That is a real conflict. That is a very difficult conflict. But it also, I think what John says here is very important to that, and that is helping them see the truth. And it may take a long, long time. It may take lots of different ways to try to communicate that truth to help them see what is really, in fact, true rather than what their heart is telling them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The thing that's important to me about what John is saying here is recognizing that however complex the dynamic and the process might be, the ultimate issue is simple. Do you believe God, or whatever else has informed whatever has created that inner voice? Do you believe that, or do you believe God? And
Or do you believe another truth? Do you believe truth that God is, this objective truth that God is saying?
Right, yeah, exactly.
I think you're right. I think it's really simple, but it's not that easy.
No, I can't claim that. But But the issue is simple.
Yeah.
That what makes it not easy in part is because that choice of whether I'm going to believe what God has said or believe what my parents have said or what my experience has taught me or whatever, what my parents and my experience have taught me is so compelling. Why would I forsake that? Why would I say no to that when we have this claim that God is saying this other thing? God seems so invisible. He seems so abstract. He seems so irrelevant to us at times. Why would I believe that? But so to make that choice to go against what seems so clearly and palpably true, to believe something that seems so ethereal and abstract just because it's from God, is a very, very difficult choice for us to make.
Yeah.
But it's the crucial one.
Yeah.
And I think framing it in those terms is empowering. It helps me when I finally realize that that's what I'm choosing between. What I'm going to accept, that the way my parents treated me is the truth about my creation, or what God, my creator, created me to be is the truth about my creation. It seems to me that when I can recognize that that's the choice before me, that somehow makes the answer more obvious than it would have been if I hadn't seen what the choice was between.
And I think there are people who are absolutely and completely counting on that truth. In the face of these voices that are screaming inside of them that that's not the truth. And they live that life every day.
Well, that I think is faith. That's what we're called to.
I've already forgotten how you explained verse 21. But as you were talking, I was thinking that it seems to me like that voice can go both ways. It can tell me that I'm worthless and like a unredeemable sinner, and it could tell me that like I'm all right, and or that I'm, it could be pride.
Right,
you know,
that's true.
Telling that I'm wonderful.
That's true.
So I was wondering, though, it seems like striking that in verse 20 he says, if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart. If our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence towards God. I was wondering if he might possibly be just saying, you know, if you feel worthless, there's the objective fact. If you feel like you're wonderful, there's the objective fact still that you have to bring yourself to. Like, whichever way that you go, like, you have to bring yourself back to the question of whether or not you're following God in your deeds and actions.
Yeah. I'm not inclined to think that that's how he's putting it, but that's the underlying truth behind what he's saying. I don't think he has in view the scenario that you described in this section at all, because he's writing into a situation where I don't think that's the issue. They are not overly confident. They're feeling condemned, and so that's the one he addresses. But you're absolutely right. I think it can go the other way, and in the other way, it's very important that we also look at the objective evidence, not my inner feelings and my subjective, self-inflated self-confidence. The issue at that point is, well, what's the objective evidence? Where have you demonstrated that you are of the truth by keeping his instructions? If you're not keeping his instructions, then your voice is lying to you.
Critique this for me. One could come away from what you're saying by saying, what my heart tells me and what my emotions and feelings say is highly unreliable in all cases and is not to be trusted.
No, it's not what I'm saying.
Okay. Can you comment further on that?
You know, actually our feelings are oftentimes very reliable, and I think instinctively, by God's design, are intended to pay attention to them and learn from them and be alerted to what's happening through our feelings. They were not given by God and planted in us by God to be liars and deceivers. It just so happens that in the fallen, sinful human beings that we are, they get co-opted by evil and get turned into a liar and a deceiver. So actually what I'm saying is, what John is concerned here is, you've got objective evidence over here, and then you have subjective feelings over here that are contradicting the objective evidence, which do you listen to? So really, in the end, all I'm saying is our feelings are only unreliable when they're unreliable, and how do I know they're unreliable? When they fly in the face of objective evidence that my own reason can get in touch with. Thank you for that important clarification.
Continuing to bang on the same issue, being raised this way and knowing of other religions that say that their hearts don't condemn us and we have confidence, that they're going to read this passage on verse 21 and just see themselves as righteous people. And can you kind of I know you've kind of gone over it, but can you kind of hit that a little bit harder for me in terms of how you deal with that verse?
Well, I see John as saying what he's saying as a motivation and an incentive to do the work that is implicit in the first claim, namely make this, hard though it may be, make this deliberate and conscious decision to allow God to speak to the issue of your status rather than your own subjective feelings. Allow God to trump your subjective feelings, as the case may be. Why would you do that? Because when the heart does not condemn you, you have confidence before God that there's a very real benefit that derives from that. You can have the freedom of knowing your eternal destiny. You can have the freedom and of having the security to know where you stand in God's eyes. That's how I'm reading it. Maybe I've missed that, but that's the only one thing that at this point makes sense to me. So by reading it, but to take it the other way can't possibly be right. I mean, he can't be saying whatever you feel subjectively about yourself, that is the case. Because if it's not the case when it condemns you, why would it be the case when it doesn't condemn you? I mean, if it's unreliable, it's unreliable. If it can be distorted, giving you distorted information, then it can be giving you distorted information both ways. So I don't think it's at all possible that John could be saying, if your heart condemns you, it's wrong. If your heart doesn't condemn you, then, yeah, that's right, you're not condemned. That wouldn't make any sense. So it can't be that. So I'm just inclined to think that what he's saying is, why would I want to take this fact that you've laid out seriously? Well, because wouldn't you want to have confidence? You know, wouldn't you want to be able to stand before God in the eyes of God and be confident of where you stood? That's why you need to believe him and not your subjective feelings. Train your subjective feelings. Silence them. As he puts it, convince them. Convince them otherwise so that you can have this thing called confidence.
Putting this question in the context of the paragraph, this is our instruction, that we believe in the name of His Son, Jesus, the Messiah, and that we love one another.
Okay. See that. Yeah.
Now, I'm a first century Jew or Gentile believer, and the apostles came and told me, this is the bottom line. Jesus is the Messiah. He's the one that was promised. The delivery promise was delivery from sin, and you need to embrace this. It's proof that God has touched your heart. Okay. And by the way, if you do that, you're automatically going to be drawn to other people who have done the same thing, who are in the same state. And you're going to want to serve them, and you should try. You should really try to love these people. So they leave, and I'm going through my life every day going, Jesus is the Messiah, and I'm working hard to love my brothers. Then along come these other teachers who are saying, no, that's not quite right. See, it wasn't sin that Jesus was really here to deliver us from. And it wasn't, loving the brethren isn't all that important. And pretty soon they're talking me back into legalism. They're talking me back into form over substance. They're talking me back into structure. And I'm shook. I'm like, oh my God, I'm lost again. Used to be this nice, religious, structured, Jewish-type person. And then they show me that didn't save me, but then they show me that Jesus did save me, but now these people are telling me, no, even that doesn't save me. And it seems to me the only issue, it's not a self-esteem issue, it's not a how my parents raised me issue, it's not any of that stuff. It's You're scared and you're lost because these smooth talkers have suddenly come by and told you Jesus isn't enough. You are not saved by your faith in Jesus. And I'm walking around going, oh my God, I'm lost. And John comes by and puts his hand over my shoulder and goes, no. You're not lost. You're not condemned. Jesus is enough. Is that what it seems to me that's what he's talking about, not all this other stuff on the periphery.
Well, the other stuff on the periphery that I brought into, because I'm extrapolating from what John is talking about. You're absolutely right. John is not talking about self-esteem or the other things that torment us in our life. He's talking about, am I or am I not saved? Does he or does he not save us? Which is the most important thing that could torment us of all the things. So he's picked the most important one. That's true. I simply was extrapolating and suggesting that the same principle that is informing John's exhortation here on this issue of our salvation also, I think, is relevant to other lesser issues, but still nonetheless very compelling issues in our lives, things like self-esteem. So I muddied the waters with that, but I just think we struggle with those other issues enough that I think it's important to realize that there's some help here in what John is saying for those as well.
I was wondering on this issue of the inner voice and what the inner voice is telling us and whether it's a matter of, you know, if our heart condemns us or perhaps in some people, you know, their heart doesn't condemn them and they're prideful. And I was wondering if John doesn't address that issue so much because if there is a dynamic in human existence where even in the most prideful or self-assured person, if they still have that voice going on inside that condemns them. I mean, if this is just kind of a given of human existence.
Could be, and the self-confidence is just a cover over that, you mean?
Yeah.
That could be.
A thought.
One thing that occurs to me is that this is, I was kind of getting lost because it seems like it's really easy, like you said, to use this verse situationally. Like, should I take this job or not? Well, does my heart condemn me? But I think it's important to remember that it's really talking about your salvation. And in that sense, can extrapolate to the point of your value because of your salvation. That was one thing I wanted to comment. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is kind of this role that God plays in that. Because it seems like it could be really easy and a lot of pressure to, especially if you don't have the clarity to separate the evidence from your emotions, to say, okay, well, I'm okay. And so I wanted you to kind of explain the difference in having faith and having God in your heart versus saying, I'm okay.
Just sort of dogmatically
asserting. Yeah, is it a mantra? I mean, it's much more than a mantra, this conversion that should happen that fights against the cloud of emotion. And I know it takes time, but I think, because it strikes me, you said something way earlier about personality, and I think there are people whose personality allows them to separate the objective reality and their emotions with a lot more ease. And for other people, there is no distinction, and I think there should be hope and encouragement and something. There's something miraculous at work. It's not just, can I think myself out of this emotion? I mean, I just keep thinking about Stuart Smalley, you know? I am a special person, and I shouldn't listen to that voice. I mean, seems like there's something more going on.
Who is Stuart Smalley?
Oh, it's a character on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, okay. Okay, so let me see if I'm getting this right. The heart of your question is, what's the difference between talking myself into something, just out shouting that inner voice, versus doing what John is talking about?
Well, and even just intellectualizing yourself out of that voice. Okay. I mean, is that faith?
Yes, if it's grounded in reality. Yes, if it's... I guess that is what I think John is describing, is, if you want to call it intellectualizing your way out of it, as long as I'm not inventing this reality, you know, as long as I'm not just lying to myself. But if I am intellectually grasping the objective reality, the objective truth, and then I'm hanging on to that as true because it's true, as opposed to what I feel might seem compellingly true, I think that's what John is saying. Yes, make that choice. Make that choice to hold on to what your mind tells you is true. Your mind functioning with integrity and soundness. And yes, that's radically different than just trying to drown out the voice with a louder voice. No, I'm going to tell myself I'm saved, rather than listen to the voice that says I'm not saved. If I have no basis for that, if I'm not, in terms of this context, if I'm not keeping his instructions and doing what is pleasing to him in the sense that John means it, if I'm not doing that, I have nothing to work with. I have no argument to make. I have no evidence to bring forth. I have nothing to convince my own mind operating with integrity that I am really of the truth. But if that evidence is there, and with my mind I can grasp the evidence and say, look at what's happening in my life. Look at what God is doing. Look at where he's brought me. He's brought me to a point where I keep his teaching. It's important to me. It's valuable to me. And it's changed my life and changed the way I look about life. On what basis do I doubt that I'm a child of God? And therefore can silence the voice because I'm trumping it with evidence of some kind.
And just the caveat to that, though, seems that ultimately God brings us the energy and the wisdom to get to that point.
That's
because
yes.
It would be really scary to think it was all up to me to convince myself.
No, that's true.
That's true. My heart's not condemning me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But the important thing to realize is that you'll run into people who are just struggling and struggling and struggling at exactly this point. Am I saved? Am I not saved? I don't feel saved. I'm not saved. And, I mean, maybe they're not. I mean, maybe what is tormenting them is that there isn't the requisite evidence. But if they are, it really comes down to, in the end, am I serious enough about this issue? Am I serious enough about even challenging the message of this inner voice, that I'm willing to look at the evidence and look at how to look at the evidence by examining the scriptures? Oftentimes you find people in a situation where they're stuck. What the scripture has to say, you begin to realize after a while, is really kind of irrelevant to them. Really doesn't make any difference what the scripture says. Well, they've already made a choice to not look at it the way John is encouraging them to look at it, if they've already decided that the scripture is irrelevant. And I think ultimately at the heart of that is a volitional choice that they're making. This is a willful decision that I'm not going to follow the truth where it actually leads. I want to listen to this voice. As tormented as I might be by it, I want to listen to it. Okay, let's have one more. Tucker had a...
This is kind of a two-part that kind of goes together. In popular Christianity today, I would say probably one strong current of thought would be to say that that voice, that condemning voice, is not necessarily arising out of the fact that my feelings and my thoughts are very influenced by the fact that I'm a sinner and all that implies, but is in fact the work of Satan. That it's the deceiver, it's that sort of spiritual battle that's going on. And kind of related to that, the second part is, it seems that also in popular Christianity, it's not, salvation is not so much, as you're saying, this voice that's condemning me versus this objective reality, but what's presented is the feelings, the voice that's telling me that I'm not saved, versus the feelings and the voice that's telling me that I am saved. It's really a subjective voice, right, against another subjective voice. And what's really going on there is this kind of grand spiritual battle, you know, that's being waged on earth as it is in heaven, kind of thing. And you know, those kind of concepts get thrown out. And I'm just kind of wondering where, you know, one, you know, how do we, or what's the difference there between saying I have these feelings because I'm a sinner versus kind of taking it outside of myself and saying it's really an external force that's trying to deceive me. And then the fact that, you know, you'll have people that say things like, well, it's not really important whether the Bible is true factually, or even, you know, that even Jesus existed or not. What's really important are just these kind of core truths that we internalize and then we can all kind of get along, I guess, you know, in some grand scheme, you know, solve the world's problems or whatever.
Okay. Wow. Well, let me take your middle point first. That's what I wish I had said. Thank you. That's a very, very important thing. I think we are so affected by a kind of stream of anti-intellectualism that we don't even know what it's like to not be listening to a subjective voice. The idea of looking at objective evidence rationally and having that convincing is really pretty alien to us in our culture. And so I guess that's it at the heart of my exhortation is, I think we of all people as believers need to relearn the art of actually crediting an intellectual grasp of the truth with its true value and weighting it as we should weight it. Otherwise, as you say, it's just pitting one subjective voice against another inside of me. And why would I trust one over the other? And that's not what John is saying. He's talking about something that's apart from and different from how we feel, what we feel to be true, but what we know to be true in another way. And many of us have not even educated ourselves in what that other way is. You know, what does it mean to know that something is true when it doesn't feel true? That's very uncomfortable to us. But we need to learn the art of that, because I think that's a large part of how God made us to function rationally and intellectually. So thank you. That's the point I wish I had made. With respect to Satan, I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. I don't have any problem with calling this the activity of Satan. I think that may very well be true. But I wouldn't pit the two against each other. I don't think it's Satan rather than my own subjectivity. If it is Satan, it is Satan working in and through somehow in a way that I don't even pretend to understand, but working in and through my subjective thoughts. So at one level, it's irrelevant whether it's Satan or not, because what I'm directly confronting are my own thoughts, whether they are stimulated by, provoked by, informed by Satan or not, I don't know. Given what we do know about Satan, it would not be inconsistent with his purposes to have some role in that. And your third point, if we really understand what the gospel is a message about the truth of what God is accomplishing in human history. If we really understand that, then it makes no sense at all to say it doesn't really matter whether this stuff is historically true, whether Jesus ever existed, et cetera, as long as these grand philosophical ideas are true, none of that other stuff matters. You know, maybe these grand philosophical ideas are interesting, but it ain't Christianity. Because Christianity is the good news about what a real God has really come and done in real history and is going to continue to do and shall do in real history in time. And that's either true or that's false. And for me to be a biblical Christian who has embraced the truth taught by Jesus, revealed by Jesus to mankind, is to believe that this history is true. So when we understand that, I think, then we don't even have the option open to us to say, well, it's not historically and factually true, but it's spiritually and religiously true. That makes no sense in the light of what Christianity claims to be. I've kept you over. Sorry.